Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in Northwest Lower Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. Over the course of the next hour, I will be having a conversation with Jerry Dennis, the author of the award-winning book, The Living Great Lakes. And then Doug Stanton and Megan Raphael will be here to talk about the fall season of the Traverse City National Writers Series. And at the end, regular contributor, poet and essayist Fleeta Brown will be here to tell us about her new book, Loon Cry, Selected and New Michigan Poems. It is with pleasure that I welcome Jerry Dennis to the Michigan Writers on the Air microphones. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Aaron.
Jerry is a native of this region and is the author of 11 award-winning nonfiction books. Today we will be talking about The Living Great Lakes. The book was the winner of the Best Book of 2003 by the Outdoor Writers Association of America. And this particular book, The Living Great Lakes, continues to attract new readers, especially now as the public becomes more aware of the various challenges facing some of the last good water left on the planet. And I keep running into people who talk about this book. It's been out for almost 7 years now, but it's a new discovery, and they're very excited about it.
Thank you.
When you were starting this project, I mean, the topic is so broad. You're covering so much territory. What was the original plan with the book?
The original plan was not too far removed from how it ended up, except that I found the key element, which was the journey through the lakes by boat. Originally, I had planned, and my publisher had agreed, that it would be a book of travels around the lakes, that I would go to places individually and get to know the place and explore the area and talk then about the larger scale of the Great Lakes story. Gradually, though, I became aware that wasn't working, that it wasn't satisfactory, that it was going to end up reading like a collection of essays, mm-hmm. and that I needed a stronger narrative to drive the book forward. And it finally occurred to me that the only way to do that was on a boat.
And then you found the boat.
And then I did. The boat found me, as the captain of the boat said. I mean, I found it right here in Traverse City, my home.
Yeah, and that was the Malabar. Why don't you tell us a bit about that boat and the journey? Because it's very interesting, you know, from a writer's point of view, that is the structure. It is sort of an on-the-road book because you take the Malabar from here all the way to the Atlantic to Maine, but you do these beautiful segues along the way. So why don't we just start with the Malabar, the condition it was in, who was on it?
Yeah. Well, I knew the Malabar fairly well. I had taken a number of short journeys on it around the bays. In fact, I had written about it the year that it first appeared in Grand Traverse Bay doing evening cruises and weddings and things, which would have been in the late 1980s. I don't remember the year exactly, probably 88, 89. And I wrote about it for the Detroit News when it first showed up. And I had been keeping an eye on her over the years and had noticed that in the couple years previous to this journey, which would have been around 1999, she was starting to look in poor shape. Mm-hmm. And the winter of 1999-2000, I noticed her listing at anchor in Grand Traverse Marina, Traverse Bay Marina. And I knew that was a bad sign for a vessel of its size to be taking on water in the winter. It was covered with tarps, but it was leaking somehow. So shortly after that, I saw an article in the newspaper that said that it had been sold to a man in Bar Harbor, Maine, who ran a business, a cruise business in Bar Harbor, and that he had hired a crew to come and repair the hull, which was leaking, and that they were going to sail the boat to Bar Harbor. So I called him and asked him if it would be possible for me to ride along. And he said, well, I have no objection. It's up to the captain, though. And he gave me his name, and he said he's living on the boat in the marina in Traverse mm-hmm. City. Go introduce yourself. And I did, and he made it very apparent immediately that not only could I come, but I was welcome to come, but also that I couldn't just ride. I had to be a crew member. And so I jumped aboard as a volunteer and helped sail and motor. We rode most of the way with the engines on to make better time, but we also sailed quite a lot, and the adventure began there.
So you very quickly saw that there are problems with this boat or with the hull of this boat.
Yeah. The Malabar is a ferro cement boat. The hull is made out of concrete reinforced with steel rods. And I wasn't aware. I knew nothing about that hull construction. It was a popular construction material for a few decades in the late 20th century. And the reason is that it's inexpensive, a lot less expensive than wood or steel. And the Malabar was one of a number of schooners that were built on the East Coast in what were the equivalent of the maritime equivalent of a barn raising. And a bunch of shipbuilders would all come together and they would pat the cement onto this this wire frame and create this hull. In one of the many bizarre coincidences that emerged as during this journey, Hyo Nuttall, the captain who was here from Connecticut repairing the Malabar, had been on that original barn-raising crew building the Malabar. He remembered building this vessel. He didn't seem to think that was extraordinary. I found it. I was speechless with the knowledge when he first told me. And so he knew the boat well. So he was rebuilding this hull where it had rotted. And it was he could only work above the waterline because it was floating in the harbor. And there were places he showed me in the bow. He punched a hole right through the bow with his fist. It was that rotted, the metal had, because the water had seeped down from the deck and had followed the steel rods and rusted them out and then started to corrode the concrete. So he was tearing them apart and repairing it. It became a very important fact of our journey that he didn't do any repairs below the waterline. He was unable to. All he could do was trust that it had not corroded down there. And he had reason to believe that it was secure. He went down with the mask and snorkel and inspected it and tapped it with a hammer. So he was fairly secure with that, the belief that it was not going to crumble beneath us, but I wasn't so sure a couple times anyway.
You mentioned that in the book. Now, before you actually start on this cruise, you go down to Chicago and you ride on a sailing ship to do the Chicago to Mackinac race to sort of get your sea legs.
That's right. That was one of the earlier journeys that I took. That was a year before that I had originally thought the whole book could be made out of.
Yeah.
And it was one of the ones that I thought succeeded and was worth telling. And that turned into quite an adventure as well. I went into it very ignorant. I'm not a sailor. I had sailed a few times with friends, but I know nothing about sailing. And I know nothing about the protocol of sailing and especially of sailboat racing. They're very serious about their racing.
Absolutely.
And an adult male who has never sailed is called ballast, and they don't want ballast.
I take it that's not a compliment.
No, it was not a compliment. I knew I was in trouble when I was walking the dock at the Chicago Yacht Club, just going from boat to boat, asking them if they had room for one more. And I noticed there was a very attractive young woman doing the same thing. She was walking ahead of me, and she was tanned and fit and obviously knew sailing. She's carrying her bag of gear. She knew what she was doing and she was going. I mean, she was attractive. She was beautiful, maybe 28 years old and beautiful. And she'd walk up the boat and go, "Need crew?" And everybody, boat after boat, and they're going, "No, no, no." And they're just waving her away. So I knew I didn't have a chance. But in one of the bizarre serendipities that occurred throughout this book, a man fell and broke his leg within minutes of my arriving at a boat, and I suddenly had a spot and was able to talk my way aboard.
And you learned a lot in that trip. Perhaps not to have a large breakfast before you set out.
I couldn't remember if you're supposed to have a large breakfast or no breakfast, so I gambled on the large breakfast, and I lost that gamble.
So the ship, the Malabar, in some ways was pretty typical of the ships on the Great Lakes 100 years ago.
Absolutely.
When there were thousands of them.
There were thousands. They were the semi-trucks of the late 19th century.
Before roads.
Yeah. Yeah, they were the cheapest way to ship goods. And it was, of course, an era when there was a lot of commerce on the lakes, transport of minerals and wood, and the arrival of immigrants. And immigrants coming the other way, many of the goods traveling east and hooking up with the Erie Canal and making their way to the East Coast, as we did. And then on the return voyage, filled with people looking for new homes. So, you know, there were so many vessels like the Malabar on the Great Lakes in those days that the largest cause of shipwrecks were collisions.
Yeah. And then you also talk about November weather, but we'll get to that in a minute. One of the interesting things that you do is you have these segues to other stories that are important stories about the Great Lakes, but weren't on your direct route. And one of them is after you sail under the Big Mac Bridge, you say something like, if Hio had turned left and gone north, he would be in Lake Superior, which gives you this whole other topic that you can work on. Then you talk about the French-Canadian voyagers. You talk about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. You tell all of those stories as well, which really provide a rich narrative. I especially liked your story about the Native American fisherman who survived the night that the Fitzgerald went down and the way you got that story.
Yeah, that was another stroke of amazing luck that did just happen to be at Whitefish Point during a very serious November storm 23 years after the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and to just happen to enter the shipwreck museum at Whitefish Point to be invited. I mean, I was invited, but it was only because I happened to show up there and mm-hmm. told them I was writing a book and introduced myself, and I was invited to attend this memorial service that was attended by descendants of the men who died on the Fitzgerald. And they had asked this man, John Lufkins, to attend the memorial and tell his story, which he had never told anyone. And he began by standing up. He was a middle-aged Native American. He was the tribal chief of the Bay Mills tribe. And he, very dignified, very humble, quiet man. He stood up before us and said, I have a story to tell. I've never told it to anyone. Mm-hmm. And you could hear the hairs on people's necks standing up. They were so silent in that room in the museum. The power was out, so it was lit by candlelight. There were several hundred candles and glass globes all the way around the room with several dozen people sitting in chairs, listening to his story of the night the Fitzgerald went down when he and his nephew were out in a 16-foot open boat on Whitefish Bay and got caught in the storm and came as close to dying as you can come without succumbing, and spent the night on an island and managed to survive it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, heroic story.
He went back out a second time and rescued two more fishermen whose boat had capsized and were clinging to the hull, and they would have certainly died. There was no way they could have survived in November in Lake Superior in a storm with 20-foot waves. 20-foot waves in Whitefish Bay.
Yes. Yeah.
30-foot in the open lake is just extraordinary.
One of the things that makes the book work so well is you have these little narratives which are so gripping, and then they're dropped into the overall structure of the whole book, because on the Malabar you also had some pretty amazing adventures and some times that were more exciting than you probably had planned on.
Yeah, there were some exciting moments, and that way of telling the story evolved as I struggled to get a structure that made sense. I knew immediately I couldn't impose it on the book. I had to let the journey tell the story. Mm-hmm. My publisher had assumed that I was going to provide a sort of conventional a history of the Great Lakes mm-hmm. with a chronological literal history and a chapter on natural history and a chapter on environmental stories, a chapter on commerce and the rise of the cities. And I had no intention of doing that. I presented it to them as one possibility, and they said, well, whatever you want to do. You know, I'm lucky my publisher has stuck with me through mm-hmm. quite a few books, and they're wide open to whatever I want to do. But I wasn't happy I knew I couldn't be satisfied with structure like that. I had to tell the stories, first of all, like you, I'm a storyteller, first of all, and then kind of slyly introduce the information. I didn't want to hit anybody over the head with the environmental story. I didn't want to preach. I wanted the facts to speak for themselves. But, you know, we none of us have the attention span or interest to listen to a whole lot of that at once. So I had to intersperse it with the stories. And it once I realized I could do it during the journey on the mail bar, it sort of fell naturally into place.
You know, and you do that also with, well, before we leave this, I do want to go back to the one bit where the Malabar gets run aground on the St. Clair River, and you almost get run over by a lake steamer.
Yeah, that was a pretty cold-hearted captain on that boat. He was not going to slow down, and we were going as fast as our little 110-horsepower diesel engine would push the Malabar down river. And we were moving along. I don't remember exactly, but it seemed like we were going 8 or 9 knots with the current. Mm-hmm. We were moving right along. And we could see this. It was the middle of the night. We could see this giant ore carrier coming behind us. It was a bend or two away. It was so enormous, and it was so lit so brightly that it looked like a football stadium mm-hmm. sneaking up on us. And we kept going, it's gaining on us. And Hayo's trying to get all the power he can out of the Malabar. And the river is not as wide as you would think.
Yeah.
And there would have been room for the vessel to pass us, but our concern was that we would get sucked into the prop wash.
Yes.
And so at the last minute, with this vessel bearing down on us, literally maybe 200 feet from us, it was bearing down on us. And there was a little canal off to the right. And we could see the lights of houses on the water, so we knew it was water, but we could also see dimples on the surface, and we were afraid it was aquatic vegetation, which meant it was shallow.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, it was. We turned into that at the last moment, ran aground with this sickening shudder. It's just an awful feeling. And this boat just comes to a halt, and then in just seconds later, this giant football stadium of a vessel passes right past us, and we were stuck. And wow, what a night. That was a long night.
Of trying to get unstuck.
Trying to get unstuck. We finally got very lucky. We had two vessels coming upstream at the same time, one right after another, and they created a huge bow wave. And as you probably know, when a wave is going upriver, like tidal bores in the Bay of Fundy, a wave going up a river creates a very steep wave, steep enough that in some places people actually surf upriver as the tide's coming into rivers. And so we saw that opportunity coming, and Hayo just turned the engines in reverse at full speed. And when that wave hit us, it lifted us enough off the bottom, we were able to zip back out into the river.
Well, you mentioned that you don't want to preach, but you are able to get in those important issues that you want to talk about by often grabbing other people's narratives. Like you talk to fishermen on Lake Erie and how the fishing has changed. And then you talk to a marine biologist who was there in the beginning of the change when the lake started to be cleaned up and what he fears. So you use other people to bring these stories together in a way that really informs the reader of the seriousness without delivering, I don't want to use preach again, but that's what it is.
Yeah. Well, that's the journalist in me. I wanted to know the full story, and I wanted to share the story. One of my motivations for writing the book was to alert people around the world of what's here, how extraordinary these lakes are.
Yeah. 20% of the world's fresh water.
It's an amazing statistic. And people don't understand it. Even, you know, the statistic, of course, doesn't carry any emotional weight. What it really takes is bring them here, standing them on the shore of the lake and said, look, you can't see the other side.
Exactly.
And so I was trying to do my best to do the equivalent of that in a nonfiction book. And it required telling the whole story, everything from the origin of the lakes and their glacial impact on them to the most recent environmental threats of invasive species and others.
Could I get you to read a bit of this so our listeners have a sense of what
sure.
the text sounds like?
Well, this...
And let me say, I'm talking to Jerry Dennis, and we're talking about his book, The Living Great Lakes.
One of the stories that I wanted to tell was of the recovery of the freshwater fishery. The Great Lakes had for thousands of years been probably the most prolific freshwater fishery on the planet. And in historical times was as well, right up until about the middle of the 1900s, 1950 to 1960, millions of tons of fish were taken from the lakes. But about the middle of that decade, the numbers started to plummet, and the reason was the sea lamprey. And we sometimes forget how devastating that was, that there was no way to check this invader from the Atlantic, which had made its way up through the canal system and actually had arrived in the early, even possibly the late 19th century. It was mm-hmm. native to Lake Ontario, mm-hmm. but it had been there so long that the ecosystem had adjusted, and there were predators that kept their numbers in check. But once they made their way through the Welland Canal, which opened for the first time in the 1830s, but was enlarged later. When it was enlarged is when the lamprey started to really arrive in Lake Erie and then make their way into the upper lakes. Once they arrived in big numbers, they devastated the native lake trout and whitefish populations and other fish. You know, just about any mm-hmm. fish that lived in the lake was prey to the lamprey. And suddenly this fishery collapsed. Well, then it's a familiar story. In 1967, then Michigan led the way with the experiment, which was a wild gamble to introduce Pacific salmon. And the results were far greater than anyone had ever dreamed. Well, I happened to be present during all of that. I was, in 1967, I was 13 years old. And my father was and is a passionate fisherman. And we had fished together all my life. And when he first heard about this salmon experiment, he got very excited. And we were among the first fishermen out in Platte Bay. And the first salmon were raised in the hatchery on the Platte River and were planted in the Platte River. And now they're returning to their native river for the first time 2 years after being planted. And in 2 years, they had grown from, you know, four or 5 inches fingerlings to 10, 12, 15-pound adults ready to run up the river and spawn. And they arrived in schools so large that pilots and planes were reporting them, saying, I see a school of fish a mile long and a mile wide swimming up Lake Michigan toward Platte Bay.
Wow.
Well, we were out there. We were among the first out there. Nobody even knew how to catch them. We were just taking the same gear we used to troll for pike and bass and walleye, throwing them into the lake, holding the rods, trolling, and having the rods practically yanked out of our arms. It was just an amazing, amazing thing to experience. But we started seeing danger signs right away. My father's a very veteran fisherman and lake person. He grew up, you know, spent a lot of time on Lake Michigan, and we were seeing canoes out there. We saw a duck scout, 10 feet long, with maybe 3 inches of
a freeboard.
We heard a report that in Frankfurt somebody tried to go out of Frankfurt Harbor in a bathtub with an outboard connected to it, but the Coast Guard stopped him. And my dad became very concerned. He said, people are going to die out here, because the weather that year was great. It was August and early September were beautiful, calm days, and the salmon fishing was so easy. You could just catch a limit in no time at all. So thousands of people are out there, literally. There were, the day that I'm writing about here, they estimated 1,700 fishermen out in Platte Bay, hundreds of boats crammed together. Well, we arrived that morning, and the weather report had, there were small craft warnings, and the weather report said there may be a storm approaching. And we got to the mouth of the Platte River and saw, it was still dark, we arrived before dawn, and the flags at the weather station that used to be at the mouth were snapping in the wind, just bang, 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 and the onshore wind was coming, and we could hear the surf. And, you know, it wasn't big waves yet, but three-footers, good-sized mm-hmm. waves pounding, 2 to 3 footers. And my dad said, well, we're not going out there, but I have a feeling we better hang around. Well, as it turned out, it turned into a disaster. The storm rose after a lot of people went out, and they had to fight the waves to get out. Once they got out, of course, it isn't as bad. You're away from the surf zone.
So.
And they're out there fishing, but it kept getting worse. And those 2 to 3 foot waves grew to 6 to 8 footers. And pretty soon people are panicking, and they're trying to run into shore, and they're trying to run their motors full bore with the waves between the breakers, trying to hit shore. And dozens of people, hundreds of people probably on shore were helping them. We would run out, we would grab the boat as soon as we could, it got shallow enough we could reach it. We'd grab and try to pull it up on shore to rescue as much of the boat and the gear as we could. But of course, next wave would hit, wash over the back of the boat, and within minutes it'd be filled with sand. But people were, you know, they were, at least were ashore and safe. In the end, seven people died. And we thought, everybody thought, the rumors were flying. The rumors were that hundreds of people had died. Well, what happened, of course, is people were getting ashore and then abandoning their boats and just heading home. And so nobody knew where they were, and the reports were coming in. But still, seven died, and it was a tragedy. Well, at one point, we got a report. Somebody came down to the mouth at the area where we were on Platte Bay and said, there's people in trouble in Empire, at Empire Beach. So my dad said, well, let's go see if we can help. So we got in our car and went down there. And my father had lived in Empire. We knew a lot of people there. And when we got to the beach at the, what is now the Empire boat ramp, at the time there, I don't believe there was a ramp, but these, we could see two men in a boat, small boat, circling just beyond the surf, and they were trying to find their way, get the courage to run to shore. They looked to be middle-aged men. They had orange life jackets on, and suddenly they went down. I watched the boat go down into the trough of wave, disappear, come up, go down, and not come up. And the next thing we know, we see these guys bobbing in the water in their life jackets. So that's where I'll pick up the reading. People on shore ran to the water's edge, carrying coils of rope, and tried to throw them. The ropes would shoot out and unfurl and hang for a moment in the wind, then come back. One man knotted a rope around his waist and waded into the waves, but he was knocked down, and others pulled him to shore against his will. Waves broke over the two men, one after another. With each wave, they disappeared, and we saw only glimpses of orange in the froth. I had sand in my eyes. I turned away and rubbed them and turned back and saw the faces of the men in the water. I made eye contact with one of them. He was heavy and gray, the age of my grandfather. He could have been our insurance man or the guy who delivered our bottled gas. He seemed apologetic. I kept expecting him to smile at me and shrug. A wave would crash over him, and after a few moments, he would come up coughing and spitting water. Every time it happened, he looked a little more apologetic. A woman standing near me put her hands to her face and screamed for somebody to do something. Children were excused from responsibility, but I was no longer a child. I was 13, nearly 14. I was old enough to help. I pitched on a baseball team and could have thrown a rope better than anyone there. I could have heaved it low and hard beneath the wind and made it straighten like a bullwhip and land within reach of first one man, then the other. I was lean and fast and swam well. I could have tied a line around my waist and dived through each wave the moment before it broke and reached the men in the calm of a trough and spoken reassuring words to them as the people on shore pulled us to safety. A wave broke over them. Their legs rose in the air but did not kick. Another wave came, and I could see two dark, slick objects rolling heavily in the spume, waterlogged. My father gripped me high on my arm and turned me away. I tried to look back, but he gripped harder and pulled. An ambulance waited in the parking lot, its lights flashing urgently. People ran past, shouting, their voices torn to fragments by the wind. The men in the water wore bright orange life preservers with bulky collars designed to support their heads above the water. They should have been safe. Everyone said if you wore a life preserver, you were safe. It was an article of faith, preserver of life. The Coast Guard guaranteed it. Our parents taught us to believe it. But the heads of the men did not stay above the water. The preservers hadn't worked. The guarantee was not valid. I had wanted to be a hero. I had wanted drama in my life. My father gripped my arm and pulled me across the parking lot past the ambulance, past people holding their faces in their hands. He put me in the car with my brother and mother. They had been there all along, watching. I will never forget the looks on their faces. For weeks, I lay in bed at night, hearing the roar of the storm and feeling the awful, draining power of the waves. I wanted to remain a child, but it was too late. Childhood fades with the knowledge of peril, and peril is everywhere. My father could not protect me from it. No life preserver could save me. They died 100 feet from shore.
Thank you. Jerry Dennis, The Living Great Lakes, truly a wonderful book. And now you have another book.
Yes, I just finished one this spring that is, it's a combination of things. It's a meditation on winter, but it takes place on the Great Lakes. I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to spend two winters living in houses around all five Great Lakes. And well, I should say 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it happened that the winter months were spent all on Lake Superior and Lake Michigan, in houses on the Keweenaw and on Leelanau Peninsula and elsewhere. And And it was originally going to be one book. I was writing about the experience of being alone in these places and unplugged, disconnected from my email and cell phone, and getting back in touch with the things I love about this region. Gradually, the book grew and grew and grew until I realized that it was more than one book. And so this first volume will be about winter and on Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. And I sort of let myself go. I just followed my nose and explored the areas and explored subjects as well that interested me that winter suggested.
Mm-hmm. Good. So when will this be in the stores?
Should be out about a year from now. Okay. In time for the winter season, well, 2011.
We can't wait to have you back to talk about that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
I'd like to welcome Doug Stanton and Megan Raphael to the show. Doug and Megan are here to talk about the fall season of the Traverse City National Writers Series. Welcome, friends. Glad you're here.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thank you.
Doug, this started, a year and a half ago, and it has been just terrific. Would you talk about how the series got started and where we're going?
It really started in Dallas, Texas, to be honest, when I was on a book tour for my last book, Horse Soldiers, and began to think of all the best things that had happened on it. And I'm basically what's a publicity tour for an author. So when I came back to Traverse City in May 2009, we had an event at the Opera House. We had a lot of friends and family. And
it was a wonderful event.
Yeah. I had people who I wrote about in Horse Soldiers on stage with me. I didn't give a reading. It was something else. It was part theater, part conversation, part moment, I guess. So something went off, and I'd been in contact with Elmore Leonard anyway, just corresponding and talking by phone. And so I said, on stage on May 29th of 2009, I said, and next month we're going to have Elmore Leonard here. And I had no real idea. But I thought, if you plant the flag, you can just march toward it. And yes. Megan does that beautifully. Actually, so Elmore did come, and he was the first guest from, quote, out of town. Mm-hmm. Although, as you know, I'd been thinking about this because we've talked about growing up in Traverse and the importance of seeing authors on the street and bringing them into young people's lives.
Yes.
It's a transformative moment. So this has been in about 10 years in the making, but it kind of gelled in May of 2009. So.
And by January.
Wow.
We hit the
ground running, didn't we?
What happened in January? It's been a blur.
Whoa, it's been a blur ever since January, I believe. Yeah, and then after that, it's been monthly ever since.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think... we've had 15 authors in some fashion, either interviewing the guest on stage or the guest themselves.
Mm-hmm. And they've been very well attended.
They have. That's been, I don't know, Megan, how you feel, but that's been
incredible. See that momentum pick up. What's interesting is that people will come just kind of mildly curious, and by the end of the evening, they are real fans. They continue to come back show after events. It's really great.
Mm-hmm.
So... can you tell us about the fall lineup? Maybe we should start with Megan on this.
It's pretty phenomenal. It keeps getting better. We start this month, September 24th, and actually it's a very special event. We have James Bradley, who is a great speaker, historian, author, and he is actually going to be announcing our scholarship winners. It's our first National Writers Series Scholarship Fund award winners. We have three of them, so he'll be handing out those awards, and then also he'll be doing an interview with Doug. So that's in September 24th on Friday. And then on October 29th, we have Peter Matheson, who we're very excited about. Two-time National Book Award winner. He's, what hasn't he written? He's phenomenal. So he's coming in October 29th. And then we round out the end of the fall with Caro Melantes with his new book, Matterhorn. And he will be also interviewed by Phil Caputo. So the combination is going to be incredible for anybody who loves great novels, interested in the war, Vietnam War, and all of us, we were talking about that today, all of us, in our 50s, 60s, 40s have been affected by it. So
absolutely. And the program has several goals. One, of course, is to bring these wonderful authors to town, but the other is to do what, Doug?
to provide positive, transformative moments on stage at the Opera House on a monthly basis that generally aspiring writers, meaning younger writers, are partaking of, so that we as a community of readers, writers, and teachers and families are saying, just by doing this, that great storytelling and clarity of thought and beautiful writing is important. Because it really is. There's two things going on here. It's a growth industry, I think, in the 21st century. The iPad is not just going to keep refreshing itself with the New York Times. There are young people in our audiences who I think will grow up to become the authors of new kinds of stories in this century. And also, the evenings are meant to be entertaining for generally aspiring authors of who are older, who are, may have careers and other things and so on. So we have a nice mix in that way.
You also have a scholarship program.
Right. Megan referenced that, and that Bradley is our speaker, our MC, our special host for this evening where we have the inaugural awarding. So on September 24th, they don't know who they are.
Mm-mm, not yet.
Well, the community doesn't know who they are yet, and they'll be announced on the stage September 24th. The point of this is that when I was a young student, I received such a grant from a local benefactor, and it really it touched me a lot because it helped a lot. And again, it's another nudge for these young people to say writing is important. We do this with movies. We do it with lots of kind of digital things. We do it with the sciences a great deal in the school system. But the odd thing is, when you really think about it, we have less kind of curricular stuff going on with communication arts than we do with the sciences.
So high school students, and I know the contest has taken place already, but have been invited to submit in a number of genres, right?
Poetry, fiction, and nonfiction.
And those have been judged?
They have.
And winners will be announced.
They'll
get scholarships if they were the winners?
Each of the recipients receives a $1,500 scholarship. They receive a class critique or master class with three people: Mika Perrine, the director of the Interlochen Center for the Arts Writing Program, Jack Driscoll, recently retired from there, and myself in nonfiction. They get publication in the Dunes Review, which is quite an honor. And they'll give a reading that evening, the 24th of September, on stage to the Opera House audience, as well as interact with James Bradley on stage.
Wow. So it's, boy, for a high school student, right. What an exciting event.
Right.
I think the other thing that it does is certainly it inspires young students and young writers, but and I think the adults in the group, those of us, and you know that, Aaron, we have such a tremendous community of readers and writers. It's amazing here. And I think it's inspiring to us to be able to see that we're passing on and how important that is for writing for ourselves and for everybody else, for young people, for personal expression, career options, and so forth. So I think it's just everybody wins on this one.
Absolutely. This region has such richness in writers, and what a heritage to pass on. Now, Doug, when you were thinking about this, this is a very different way of having authors bring their work to an audience. The usual way is to go on a book tour, settle in the corner of a bookstore, and hope that some people show up. So what's the buzz with this particular approach to...
Well, we have large audiences consistently. For instance, when Audrey Niffenegger was here earlier in the year, I asked her, and she said, well, this has actually been the largest audience on my book tour, and she'd been all around the country for her trade paperback of Her Fearful Symmetry. Now, Traverse City is a special place. We have a huge book-loving community, but what we do is we reach out to the likely people who are going to be interested. So if I was bringing a crime novelist in, I would go to the criminal justice students over in Northwestern Michigan College. I'd come out to Interlochen and ask the sociology, the students studying history or sociology,
yes,
or history of protest, or et cetera. Anything had to do with people in the courts. This is what publishers used to do, but they don't have the time anymore. So the National Writers Series is really a new kind of book marketing, book tour event that has caught the eye of publishers, because we sell a lot of books for the author and we have big crowds. And I have to tell you, if it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. But I think it's important because what it means is that if we think about this event, all kinds of authors can have book tours. There are people out there to buy books. You just have to find them and you have to bring them in. And mm-hmm. that's one of the missions of this, is because right now in the economy, the way publishing is working, only the authors at the top of the list really get a book tour. That's unfair. The mid-list authors deserve one too, because mm-hmm. they can sell books as well. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to fix that whole problem in publishing right now, but it has caught the attention, and I think that this is a successful way.
Well, it's a wonderful program. Megan, do you want to recap what's going to happen and when?
Yes, we have James Bradley in September 24th, and Peter Matheson October 29th, and Carol Merlenti's in November 12th. And we are in the process of putting together a huge, great lineup for 2011. So we are coming back every month from January through June, and then again next fall. So we haven't completed yet the lineup, but we're talking with some pretty outstanding authors and who have great stories to tell.
Well, I've been there at everyone, and they've all been very exciting evenings, and I'm looking forward to this fall.
Good.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks, you, Aaron.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. An essayist, Fleeta Brown, is here. But this month, instead of talking about the work of other poets, she'll be telling us about her recently released book, Loon Cry, Selected and New Michigan Poems. Welcome, Fleeta.
Hi, Aaron. It's good to be here again in this different way.
Ah. And your new book, Loon Cry, Selected and New Michigan Poems, is a celebration of your family's long connection with this region. And all the profits from this book go to support the Watershed Center, Grand Traverse Bay.
Yeah, the idea was that I would, I've been thinking about doing a book like this for a long time, and what I wanted to do is put together poems specifically about this region, poems that I've written over a lot of years. They're poems from my first book, which was way back in 88, and as well as recent poems, and I just thought it would be really nice to have all those Michigan poems in one place.
You know, your history is so interesting because your family has been summering in this region for more than 90 years.
Yep. The year my father was born is the year the cottage was bought.
And five generations of your family have spent summers in the region on the shore of Intermediate Lake.
That's right.
I've got the right lake.
You've got the right lake, although we always called it Central Lake. I didn't know till I was grown that the title was Intermediate Lake.
Ah.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a beautiful location. I've had the pleasure of being there. The place part of so many of your poems is this region.
Yeah, I really think that everybody has a place. You know, all writing comes from a place. And if it doesn't come from a place, then I'm not very interested in it. And this is the place that my work comes from. It always has been. Even when I was in Delaware, I think I spent an awful lot of time writing Michigan poems. It's my place.
Mm-hmm. And your book of essays, Driving with Dvorak, place is still here also.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
although
yeah.
Although you cover much of your life.
I do, but the place that it always returns to is Michigan.
So can you give us some of these poems, old or new? Perhaps you'll give us a preface to each one before you read it.
Sure. I will start with an old poem that...
We should talk about the book, because the book will be going on sale this week through the Watershed Center. And the cover of the book is by
Glenn Wolfe. We asked Glenn, And he volunteered this. Everything about this book has been donated. I have donated the work. Glenn Wolf donated the art, and it's the cover art and some inside art. And Heather Shaw donated her time in editing. And so she designed, say really editing, she designed the book. And
So a poem? Or two, or three, or four?
Here is an old poem, and I really don't think there's anything much I need to say about it. It's pretty self-explanatory. The name of this poem is Doc, and I'm just playing with the word Doc. Say Doc, Doc, it's just a hollow of itself, the way the foot echoes between wood and water, the plank of it, like piano keys, growing hollower farther out under the stars. Listen to the way Doc's closed in by the tongue on one side, pushed out at the far end toward the lake with a duck sound, quack sound, where they congregate for crumbs. It's even a tongue itself, saying nothing but what you bump against it, or an arm reaching out. Here you're willing to make yourself sociable, declare yourself separate from the trees. Doc, here you offer. Here is a place to stop. And it's true. Indeed, I have to stop at the end and think. The reason for walking out here is how the end goes blunt. You feel your blood turn back toward the heart, but for an instant you imagine it longs to keep moving out, like Roadrunner at the edge of a cliff, keeping on with nothing built to hold him up. Turning back, I carve a cul-de-sac in the air, which is a comfort and a sadness.
Lovely.
I love the dock because at our cottage, there's almost no front yard. The dock is so close to the water. So the dock is what we have. It's our front yard. Well, let me read you another poem. This one isn't specifically cottage, but it does have that in it. It goes other places, too. It goes to Missouri also. It's called For Grandmother Beth, who was my step-grandmother. Just one scandalous year past our grandmother's death, the second wife stood homely and trembling, ankle deep in the lake, taking on water and family at once. Once, she told me, your grandfather found the box of hair your grandmother saved when she had it bobbed. She said he cried, and I tried to imagine both wives working it out in heaven. He took this second one, taught her theories of economics, gave her his grown children and grandchildren, money and houses. They used to sit at the kitchen table and eat prunes, the same table where he ate prunes with my grandmother. Regularity took him to 95, although the last year in the nursing home, he couldn't remember who she was, and even years before that, at the lake, he'd call her by his dead wife's name. No, Harry, she'd say, it's Beth, Beth, and lead him back to where he meant to go. She never touched the money he left her, saved it for his children, took in rumors, and lived on interest. Now she's dead, and all Garth Avenue is gone from me, from us, the house, the lilies of the valley on the north side. Oh, it would be a long list, and who cares now but us? This is what I have to say for her, who held a place and saved everything, as if she had no needs or wishes except to be no trouble at all and to die quickly. A light turned out to save electric bills.
That's so interesting. And on the walls of your cottage are all of these old photographs.
Yeah.
And all of these people.
And all of these people. Would you like me to read another poem?
Sure.
Okay. I'll read a new poem. I did put, this book probably has maybe 10 new poems in it. I wanted a sprinkling of new work. This one is really different, which is kind of why I want to read it. It's about the kind of day that you don't know what to say anything about because it's so absolutely perfect in every way. And those are so rare and especially, you know, here when I say it's a perfect day, of course, I mean the temperature for me is warm. So anyway, this is called The Kind of Day. Sun on the waters bouncing ripples to the top of the big pine as if the world's underwater. The air's so exact on my skin, there's no air and no skin. The kind of day that's not a kind of day, but a peeling back. The kind of day I keep restlessly trying to use well because it's so absent of difficulty. It requires taking on the thought of mist, of rain. It requires making trouble. I don't know how peace can stand it. I pick wild mint and chew it up. I pick purple aster, Queen Anne's lace, even when they are leaning toward nothing, fields already golden, the word golden humped up at the front, tumbling at the end, so easily it feels motionless, the sky itself only an exhalation of the earth into so many capillaries it can no longer be identified as itself. The kind of day that makes you give up hope out of sheer frustration, which of course is just when the centaurs and the acrobats finally have a chance.
Fleeta, do you have one more, a recent poem?
I have a poem called Northern Pike. My grandson almost caught a northern pike, which almost scared the dickens out of him. He came back white as a sheet. So northern pike, I looked up some interesting facts about it and discovered that it can hover in the air in the water because it has this swim bladder that it releases air from or not, and it just can hover without moving anything, just a few feet below the top of the water, which I thought was an interesting fact. Also, it's interesting that it chomps right through its prey sideways. It takes a fish instead of sucking it in the way most mm-hmm. creatures do. It bites it right through the middle. Okay, northern pike. Just past the railroad bridge, over the Green River, the deep pool, dragonflies and white moths, where you can see the huge fish hovering. And Zach with his skinny arms leaning and the whack of the line, the wrenching. I wish I could save him from his nightmares, his waking fear of muggings, of bombs, of what there is legitimately to be afraid of. Up came the pike, nearly 3 feet long, teeth set on the line. I didn't see this. Zach came back with the fact of it in his face, terror and the joy of terror, the pike down there in his soul, making up its mind without thinking, moving up and down like a submarine by shifting molecules of gas from its blood to its swim bladder, not a motion of the body involved, waiting to clamp fish, frogs, children, sideways in its teeth, nothing to do with consciousness, with will. And here is Zach to tell me, as if I hadn't been there myself, watching the worst come up because I fished it up out of its waiting and almost went down with it to the green and gloom, to the churning ghosts, as if I hadn't won too when the line snapped, the weight of it lasting forever in my skinny arms.
Fleeta Brown, the poet, and the work is Loon Cry Selected and New Michigan Poems. The publisher is Watershed Center, Grand Traverse Bay, and it's available from?
It's available at bookstores. It's available directly from the Watershed Center. You can get that online. Please buy a copy because the $15 plus $2 shipping, if you decide to do that, the $15 goes entirely to support the Watershed Center, every dime of it. The Watershed Center is responsible for monitoring and advocating for the entire 1,000-mile area of watershed of the Grand Traverse Bay area, and 60% of the surface water of the lake comes from that area. So it's a really, really important work that they do.
Fleeta Brown, and the work is Loon Cry Selected and New Michigan Poems.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Jerry Dennis, Doug Stanton, Megan Raphael, and Fleeta Brown for making time to be on the show. My gratitude to our sponsors, IPR Radio and Michigan Writers, Inc. Check out the website at www.mishwriters.org for a great group supporting writers and readers in the area. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.